Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
And the crowd went docile. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. And like Harold likes to say, the unknown universe is around us all the time. The aspect of the veil, where there's things going on around us all the time we have no knowledge of. And, hey, that I fit right into that. Half the time I'm not aware of what's going on around me. So most of the time I'm in the unknown universe. I would like to acknowledge WNAH. That's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse. Hoyt is the station manager and the only employee other than Tony. Tony is a contract salesperson. And those are the two guys that run WNAH. And they do a great job. Hoyt hasn't taken a day off in 9 years, and he doesn't remember the time before that. I think it's a form of insanity myself, but he cannot not go to work. They give us this opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this as a public service presentation. I understand now that the we don't represent AA or NA or Narcoleptics Anonymous. This is Rum Radio. Although we do use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is their basic text. And the reason I do that is because that's the template for all 12-step recovery. That's the mother of it all. That's where it all comes from. Other than the first line of the book, where it mentions the addictive substance of alcohol, all the other 12-step programs have the different addictions in there, and most of them are just verbatim out of those steps. So steps work for any addiction that I've encountered. And right now, AA on the GSO website is promoting Impress Radio and Films, and they're doing that as a public service presentation. Some people would decry that this is against the traditions. To me, the only question that's needed to answer if there's from the traditions is, does this divert us from our primary purpose or does it help? That's the only question that needs to be asked. And I believe if this is a help, if it helps one person, I'm going to go with it. I'd like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals that affords us some print space from time to time. And I'd like to gratefully introduce my co-host, Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist, and he does a fine work with troubled families. And I personally believe that the family is the basic unit of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. Families are being beset on all sides. The phenomenon is getting greater and greater. I believe this is a time when good is taken for evil and evil is taken for good. If the children are taught correct principles, the chances are that the society will knit together. If the children are left to grow up in abandoned weeds, we're in for a heck of a ride. Harold?
Well, thank you, Joseph. I appreciate that introduction, and I agree that was part of my childhood and early adulthood is the weed part. I smoked a lot of weed, and actually I was self-medicating, having all the leftover feelings from having a rough childhood. And so when I reached adulthood, I wanted to go to college and try to get into a field where I could help kids. And so working with kids one at a time is one thing, but I soon learned that I had to help the parents if I really wanted to help the kids. 1 hour with a therapist a week wasn't nearly enough energy to overcome 167 hours with parents that were off the hook. And so that's what we do. I work with a lot of parents, get them back on track. And I'm a Christian family therapist. I work at the Houston Center for Christian Counseling. And the it's really something, the teamwork and the love that we have on the 40 therapists working together is a first for me. It is really wonderful. They never have any turnover, so I'm really fortunate to and blessed to find a position there. But let me take a moment to mention that for our listeners, Joseph does not make money on this website. He has sunk thousands into it, as a matter of fact, as his way of giving back. We offer this as a public service. It's all about working with others, which is really the thing that makes recovery go. And I owe my life to that very concept. I've worked with a lot of people. A lot of people have worked for me. They were there when I came into the rooms, and now we want to make sure that people are there and in the right mindset when the new guy comes into the room or the new woman. They are the most important person in the room, the new person. So if you've been thinking about going to AA or NA or Celebrate Recovery, get up off the couch and go, because you'll be warmly welcomed and it can change your life. It changed mine. So thanks, Joseph.
Thank you, Harold. Tonight we're going to have John L. I met him on the one of the Facebook groups. Pretty interesting fellow. I'm going to get a little bit more into that. Are you there, John?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Good to be here with you two tonight. Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate you taking the time, and especially on Super Bowl, and the Super Bowl is coming down. It's got really good. I was hoping it was going to be a blowout, but no, I'll have to watch the rerun. I know one of them is going to win. That I know for sure, but I'm not quite sure.
Well, it reminded me of my weekend drinking. If they had filmed it, it would have made a very poor Super Bowl commercial.
The commercials are kind of light this year so far. I've listened
right.
to a couple of the commercials.
John and Dumpster. Right. John and Dumpster looking for raincoat and car keys. You know, they wouldn't have sold much old milk. They wouldn't have sold much old Milwaukee if they'd filmed me.
Old Milwaukee, the beer that made was that the beer that made Milwaukee famous? Was that it, or is that no? That was
no.
Pabst
that Ribbon.
Was that Pabst.
Yeah,
beer
I meant when I was a teenager, my father's ultimate threat was to move us to Milwaukee.
Oh, Jay. Anyway, before we get into your story, I'd like to open up with the third step prayer. And it's found on page 63 of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, the primary text for AA. Now, there's other NA and CA, and there's even a Paranoids Anonymous, but nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. So this is the basic text, and this is on page 63 of the basic text. Third step prayer, also called the surrender prayer. It's one of the early assignments I give to a new sponsee. When I get my sponsee, the first thing I ask them, I usually go find them, they find me, and I always ask them the same question: have you had enough? Usually if they've had enough, they know what I'm talking about. If they haven't had enough, they'll usually question what that means. Have you had enough pain? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? Yes. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. Okay, I got those two affirmations. Not only they told me, they told themselves. And then I said, okay, first, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And then I usually pull out Clancy's 7 questions. It's on the website under how to find a sponsee. Find it very productive. I believe luck is nothing more when preparation meets opportunity. So if you're prepared, you're going to find your sponsee if that's what you're looking for. If you're not prepared, chances are not as well. Somehow it's kind of magical. When you prepare yourself, things happen. Knock. And so I carry that with me. I hand them the seven questions. I'll say, first thing I need you to do is answer these seven questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. Expect your call. And actually, I'm done until they call. If they don't call, I'm okay. One of two things happen. Either they're not ready for me or they're not ready, which in any case is okay. I believe that I don't chase them around. I believe that we avoid what pursues us. I don't pursue anybody. If they want what I have, if they want the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that I present, they're more than welcome, and I'll tell them, I'll give them as much effort into their sobriety and recovery as they do, no more and no less. And so I ask them to go get a home group, and in that home group to get about 30 men's names. If they have a newcomer's packet, that's great, or go a little too early to the meeting, have the chairperson circulate a piece of paper so they can get men's names, men with men and women with women. Usually we find that to work the best. It's a very intimate relationship between a sponsee and a sponsor, and that intimacy can be easily misconstrued with opposite sex, and sex changes everything. But if you can't find the same-sex sponsor, the agreement is you work the steps. And then when you can, you get the same, but if not, you work the steps. And I'm okay with that too. The idea is we work the steps, and to call one of these gentlemen every day, get permission, that's why they put their phone numbers, made it available. Call him every day for the next 30 days, one fella, different fella every day, and ask him permission to recite the third step prayer. I get him to do that, one, to get him used to picking up the 500-pound telephone. Two, they get to know his name, and he gets to know their name. He's connecting up with his home group and his lifeline. Can't always get a hold of your sponsor, but one of those names will be available. You try hard enough. You're thinking about drinking or you need some support, somebody will be there. If you have enough names, somebody will be there. You know, we might not go to the wall, but we'll definitely meet you at Starbucks. Folks are real good about that. Third reason encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, the fellow you're calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol. Chances are he will not do that. No guarantee, but your sponsee is now also into service work, which is part of the key of recovery. And this is the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen.
Amen. That's a...
Thank
That's
you.
A backbone.
This is. I want to give you a little thumbnail on John so you see what John's about. John L. is an editor, an attorney, an essayist, and an ex-problem drinker. John can and often does discuss AA history, sociology, and literature with the confidence of a learned man's experience. John is also in the forefront of the internet revolution of bringing the recovery discussion to and through the Facebook interactive. It's an interactive phenomenon. It's how I met John and know John from the Rowdy Rum. It's one of the groups. They're known for their ability to discuss a wide range of recovery topics with the least amount of censure and the greatest amount of open-mindedness. But you got to remember, if you get 15 alcoholics in a room, you're going to get 20 opinions. One member related to John is a modern-day Bill W., who was chief architect of the 12-step recovery movement. So, John, tell us, we usually discuss what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. And then if we get any callers that have any questions, I can give them the number and see if anybody'd like to call in. I know it's the Super Bowl, so I understand. 949-534 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621. So, John, what was it like?
My name is John L., and I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous.
Hi, John.
I had my... I had my last drink in midair as I was being flung out of Chief's Cafe on a cold December 4th morning more than 20 years ago. I crawled to detox, my fourth of four detoxes that morning. I had a blood alcohol of 0.41. I was experiencing mood swings. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1986 on a scholarship from my employer, that had noticed that my drinking was peculiar. And I was pretty adept at getting a year of abstinence. I got a lot of one-year medallions. But every 12 or 13 months there came a day when I had no effective mental defense. And I binged for about a week, and I'd end up in detox. Happened four times. With ascending blood alcohols, they were like 39, 40, 41.
I thought at that range that it was like near death.
Lethally say it's 45 to 50. And
you at least had another one or two drinks in you.
Right. Legally drunk at the time was 0.10 or 10. Most of the states is down to 0.08. So I was five times the legal limit.
Yeah, but I've known people that have died, I think, at five.
Right. Yeah, I've taken a half dozen people to detox in the last 2 years for that had blood alcohols over 40. So it's
wow.
As much as we inject some levity into it, it is life and death for a lot of people. And I was one of these meeting makers that didn't make it. I mean, that's my story in about 15 seconds. The short version is I never had to be detoxed until I quit drinking.
Yeah.
And, I was excellent at getting 12 or 13 months, and I'd have a bigger explosion. I remember telling on my third detox, telling the intake nurse, I had a 0.39, and I told her I never drank that much when I was drinking. And the big book tells us that any scheme based on avoiding temptation is doomed. It generally ends up in a bigger explosion. And unfortunately, that was my experience, that I did my most explosive volatile drinking when I was trying not to drink.
Yeah.
I find that a lot with the rehabs and, where you're sequestered into a place for 30 days or 60 days. To me, it seems like it builds up the demand. You're not able to go get a drink, but the demand is still there. Now they let you loose back into the world, and there's liquor on every street corner. What's your take on that?
Well, with 25 years of hindsight, I would say it turned out to be a bad thing that I got sober right out of the gate for a year and a half. Basically on fear and fellowship, Joseph.
Yes.
Yeah, I was working on my man. I was just basically going to a noon meeting in downtown every day, and then going to a meeting in my home area at 8:30, 9 o'clock every night. So, and just keeping my nose clean, going to work, just generally behaving. But I would describe my first 4 years in AA as fear and fellowship, and the last 22 years I would describe as faith plus action. So, and I think those seem to be the two major ways to do AA, and I've tried them both. I lived on fear and fellowship for 4 years, and I didn't drink that often, but when I did, it was the closest I've ever come to death. And the last 4 years, I've started every morning asking for a divorce, as it recommends on page 86 of our book. I've asked for a divorce itself. I've asked the God of my understanding to send me somebody to help, and I've not been directed back to Chief's Cafe since I started doing that. I'm pleased to report I haven't had a thought, an urge, an inkling to drink for over 20 years, not for 2 seconds. I got that by accepting the gift.
You know what I find interesting, though, and you're a learned man. You're an attorney, right? You were a practicing attorney.
Oh, yeah. I have three degrees. I was always the most knowledgeable patient detox.
My experience is, and I've known some really brilliant alcoholics, and it seems that because their mental acuity is so advanced, that their capacity to drink copious amounts of alcohol is mind-boggling and still maintain some semblance of vertical movement. You know, I was kind of a lightweight, so it just kind of shocked me when
There's some truth to that. See, the lawyer's answer to every question is it depends. You always be right. Get a billable hour out of it. But basically, I went to a small high school. I had 92 people in my high school class, my senior class. It was a small high school, but it was very tough academically. They had a good athletic program. And we got I was the second youngest in the whole class. And we got our senior yearbooks. I was still 16 years old. I was the second youngest.
Wow.
And they gave us our yearbooks in October of my senior year in high school. And at lunchtime, everybody exchanged yearbooks and wrote inscriptions in each other's yearbooks about our 4 years together. And I probably had 50-some inscriptions in my yearbook. And I'm 16 years old, and at least 9 people use the word alcoholic under my picture on the inside cover. Now, this is long before I would have considered it a problem.
most likely to go to rehab.
Well, they didn't mean classy alcoholic, but I had lettered in 5 sports. I was about 10th in my class academically, and I was pretty active socially. I was in a lot of clubs and updated frequently, and I would have thought I kind of impressed myself I was able to get good grades and drink like that, because my parents traveled quite a bit, and, my brother and I had the run of a bunch of summer houses year-round, so we weren't quite closely watched. I mean, the police never showed up, and I would have thought it was kind of an accomplishment to drink and get good grades. Again, that turned out not to be such a good history.
But you were able to do that.
Well, if the best 12-step workers in the world had come to me at age 16 or 17 or 19 even and said, John, do you want to stop? And I'd say, no. If they told me how been successful in their lives, how this AA thing had worked, I would have said, that is so wonderful and inspirational. I'm so glad it's helped you guys. I probably would have given them some names of people that could have helped. I did once. What happened a few years later? I'm in my 20s and I can't stop when I want to.
I say that's the primary purpose sometimes, because there's a lot of young kids in there, which is kind of unusual, blows me away still to see them there, 17, 18, 19, just young. And for an alcoholic, it's unusual. Usually it's longer, but I believe it's because of the drugs, the cocaine, the powders are hitting them to the cement that much harder. Of course, they do alcohol on top of that too, because of the availability, and now they're coming in. And I say to them, you come in and look at all the fun you're going to miss. Like, we're old timers. We've had our fun. Now we're telling you, you're not going to have any fun. You're not going to get the fun of getting put in jail. You're not going to have the fun of going to prison. You're not going to have the fun of losing relationships. You're not going to have any of that fun. All that fun you're going to miss.
Well, I went to 4 years of good colleges, got a master's degree, a bachelor in science, a doctorate in law, and I don't think I ever had, so seven and a half years of graduate education, I don't think I ever had a drink other than a Friday or Saturday night, but it was basically last for 3 days. I mean, it was
one drink for 3 days, right?
If I didn't have a test or a date coming up, I would drink. I'd go to like a neighboring college, like at Dartmouth or Holy Cross or Wesleyan or one of the New England schools, and I would just, you know, next thing I know, I'd be in Ann Arbor, Michigan, you know, giving somebody a ride home. You know,
okay.
I started out completely, I started out like at Hanover, New Hampshire, and, you know, all the license plates were white, and I'd be on this, you know, 12-lane super highway, you know, and pulled over, and all the license plates were blue. And I knew I was in a different, I wasn't in Kansas. I mean, I was.
That's funny.
No,
I never heard
that. Vermont, all the license plates are green. They're white in New Hampshire. Neither state has 12-lane expressways anywhere. I mean, I'd been around enough. And, you know, I really did. I mean, I put my hood up and remember trying to find out where I was. I mean, I drove in a blackout from Hanover, New Hampshire to Ann Arbor, Michigan. And basically, when I was 17 years old, I went to school in Boston, and I turned my life over to vodka in the next 30 days. And, you know,
wow.
A lot of strange things happened. I mean, I met my future ex-wife at a party on Cape Cod. I had that misunderstanding of driving to Michigan. I was in Paraguay for 3 days. I was in the U.S. Marines for 48 hours. And I finally decided at the end of the 30 days it was time to slow down, so I decided to go to the boat show in the downtown convention center in Boston. You know, thinking that what's safer than an indoor boat show? Well, yeah, I got into a ring that night with Victor the Boxing Kangaroo, you know, which was a bad idea, something I would never have done sober. You know, that's the
reason. What was the outcome of that
I was a victim. I was a victim of false advertising. Victor was not a boxing kangaroo. He was a kicking, throwing kangaroo. That match lasted. It was like $500 if you could stay in the ring for 3 minutes. And
how long did you last?
So anyway, I decided after that first 30 days that I had probably been more selective on my drinking nights. So I basically would just do it every other weekend. And I'd haul my sorry butt into the library Sunday morning and, you know, sweat it out. And I wouldn't drink for another 10 days or so. But
oh,
I didn't
wow.
count. I used to be
when
really
active. When did
it
finally come up to a head?
Oh, 20 years later, Joseph.
That long? Wow.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, I got a scholarship from my employer in the mid-80s. Because I mean, that's why I tell people I never had a problem with my drinking. You know, the Pittsburgh police had a problem with it. Most of my wives had
right.
a problem. Several of my bosses were really irritated. And I basically kept some pretty good jobs. I mean, I worked in Wall Street and in finance for about 15 years. And I was traveling constantly. When I wasn't in New York, I was raising bond money, doing underwriting all over the country. And that's really where I started doing all this editing. I basically was a highly paid proofreader. And, you know, you'd be literally at the printer all night doing galleys and annual reports and portfolios and prospectuses. So I'd be eating French food at the printer at 3, 4 in the morning, but the only problem was you weren't supposed to drink until you finished work at 6 or 7 a.m. That was the only drawback to it. So I basically kept work because I kept a job because I wasn't around my office very often. I really wasn't being supervised. And
did you
I only
keep
had a
the job so you could keep drinking, or you just kept the job?
Sure.
Because
yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, protect the supply was paramount.
I hear that a lot. I know that a lot, that some of the best employees are alcoholic. They're drunks, and the reason why, they're there every day. They do at least an adequate job. And you could be sure that they're going to be there the next day, because if they lose that mm-hmm. job, they don't have the ability to buy.
Well, I mean, I think that I think it's about the last thing to go. And that,
right.
This is your job. It's generally going to supply your ability to drink. I mean, the idea about alcoholics being the smartest people or the best workers, I mean, that's something that you will only hear at an AA meeting. I mean, I don't think
Amen.
You'll hear that very often. I don't think you'll ever hear that in an Al-Anon meeting or a presidential
no.
address.
No,
So this kept going, and then I take it there was a wife. Any children?
No, no children I know of. They would have been born in the early 80s if I had children. I lived with three women in the 1980s in Pittsburgh, in a nice section of Pittsburgh. I didn't live in it wasn't at the same time. It was one at a time. And, prior to living with me, none of them had ever seen a psychiatrist. And inside of a few months of living with me, every one of them was seeing a psychiatrist at least once a week. And it was pretty obvious to me what was going on. I mean, I picked sick women. It was nothing wrong with me. That was my perception at the time.
There was a fellow up. I go to the Crested Butte Mountain Conference. I hadn't been for a while, but I had gone pretty regularly. And there was a fellow up there one time sharing in a meeting, and he had this real southern drawl. And he said, my picker was broken. And I said that several times. And when I went to share, I said, before I start my share, I want to say how sorry I am for the guy with the broken pecker. And he got real upset. Everybody laughed. I just did it as a joke, and the joke was on him. And he was angry at me for a while. Then the next year he came, he said, he wanted to be friends. He says, I've used that in several meetings, and I've always gotten a laugh. But the point is that we're going to go after, I can speak for myself, I always go after crazy women. Probably women as crazy as I am, and now that now it's dangerous. Now there's two of us.
Well, I don't know that I was all that discriminating. It would be like, who would put up with me at the time? Some were drinkers, some weren't. The second or the third woman I lived with in the 80s was this lovely woman named Beth, and we lived together for about 2 years, and then she married an FBI agent and moved to Virginia, and I didn't realize I was living alone for about 3 weeks.
That's funny.
I was fixing my cocktail after a hard day of work one evening, and noticed something seemed very stark about my home. It just was kind of barren. So I was like looking in all her closets, and there was all her clothes were missing. So I called her mother, lived in the North Hills of Pittsburgh, and I said, Jane, have you seen Beth anywhere? And she said, well, she moved to Virginia, but it had to be a month ago. Did she tell you?
That's funny.
I think that's what I like about it. I like the stories in Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, that's a specific story that paints a general picture.
Yeah, sure.
We get that format from How It Works. I don't think the book wants us to generalize or tell in a vague way. I think we tell through the specifics of our story a general picture that we were like out to lunch a lot.
What was the bottom though? Where your bottom should be coming up? I would think.
I'm not a big fan of the bottom. I mean, I know that's been with AA since day one. I mean, I don't think it's a useful concept, Joseph, because I didn't know my bottom until I was 4 or 5 years sober. I didn't think I was going to stay sober, so I wasn't even paying that much attention to my story. I mean,
AA? I mean, something had to get you in there.
I had a scholarship from my employer said, you need to stop drinking. I mean, I was a highly paid employee. In fact, I was involved in, like, nuclear licensing and raising money. Basically, I was a financier, investment banker.
Right.
And we were building 9 nuclear plants, and they're like $1 billion worth of plants. So I would be all over the country, like getting parts for canceled plants, and I was on the road constantly. And they used to have like wake up calls in the hotels in the 70s and the 80s. And I hate that, getting a jarring wake up call at 6 or 7 in the morning after you've been out all night.
Yeah.
So I would call the desk and have them place a wake up call to the room on either side of me. to wake them up. And I could hear them yelling at the desk clerk through the wall. And that was a lot less obtrusive.
That's a great idea,
that's how I designed things, right. I mean, protect the supply, continue to drink. I mean, the principal reason I didn't quit is I didn't think I could. Nobody nobody from Alcoholics Anonymous. One person in Akron, where I used to work fairly frequently, did. He was a second-generation Akronite member. And I was, I had actually replaced him. He was, there are factories named after him in Ohio. And he was a pretty well-known Akron member. And I was at a cocktail party. I was actually replacing him. He was getting promoted to chairman of the board of a company. And I actually was his 27-year-old replacement. He was 62. And he came up to me at this cocktail party on 40 South Main Street, about three doors down from the Mayflower Hotel, coincidentally.
The Mayflower, some of the listeners don't know, the Mayflower is part of the AA lore and legend. That's where Bill W. Eventually got to me through that auspice, got to meet Dr. Bob and start AA as we know it today.
Well, what happens is I am like getting appointed to be a vice president. I'm a kid. I'm still in my late 20s. And, you know, this guy should have been my mentor. And all he had to say to me was, he's not giving me any job advice. He said, young fellow, I used to drink just like that. He said, if you ever want to quit, just come up to the office and tell Margie you're a friend. You don't need an appointment. And I said, well, thank you very much, sir. And I assiduously avoided him for the next 3 years. He is the only person in AA who tried to help before I actually got sent to meetings, you know, by my employer.
Oh, so that's okay. So, I had a sponsee like that. He was a human resources vice president locally here in Houston, and he had to go. His employers insisted that he either goes into they sent him to rehab while I was working for him. I don't think that worked out as well as it could have, but he had to come in, and I believe the had to come in actually hurt our relationship, taking him through the steps personally. But that was that particular story. So now you had to go. You had to have your paper signed or some acknowledgement that you're going, because they're not trusting you, I imagine. And you're going in and you're going to try to get this thing through, I call it the process of osmosis. You're going to sit in enough meetings and you're going to get enough message where you can drink like a gentleman. Is that about it?
That's a large part of that applied to me. I mean, I was working for all these utility companies. I was a management consultant. I was actually vice president of the holding company managing 8 utilities. And my title was senior vice president and manager. Now, my job was to look at these companies and try to identify management problems and propose a fix. Now, with that background, you would think I would be able to recognize that I myself had a management problem with my life.
Oh, no way.
I mean, I was a highly paid management consultant, and I'm basically oblivious to the management problem in my own life.
I went to Texas.
You know, as you probably know about the utility industry, it used to be very decentralized. It was like a bunch of the cities had their own utilities, and every state had 10 or 20 utilities. You know, and now they've been consolidating the last 25 years. And I actually got called in to Texas by a company that became Enron eventually. And they were going to acquire some of the companies that I was consulting for. So they called in the 8 vice presidents from the Midwest. They brought them into Texas. And all 8 of us got to have individual conferences with the head of personnel for this giant emerging energy company. And they would try to, like, induce us to sign 5-year contracts so we wouldn't jump to another utility. And if we signed with them, we would remain with them for 5 years, like restrictive covenants.
Right.
Well, I was the youngest of the 8 vice presidents that got called to Texas for this conference. And the other 7 spent the whole 2 hours with this vice president, you know, going over fringe benefits they were offering in order to sign for 5 years. You know, they were getting trace offs and ESOPs and stock options and deferred pension. And well, anyway, the director spent almost the whole.
So you go to AA now, right? So you're forced into the rooms of AA. You walk in, and now what? You feel comfortable there? You feel alienated there?
Not a bit. I do two questions from Dave for the first 6 months. 2 questions went through my mind every time I walked into a meeting. Number one, I don't belong here, and number two, this isn't going to work either.
Yeah.
I mean, I was the most surprised person that I didn't drink for a year. I mean, I was surprised as anybody who ever came to AA. It was basically, like I said, on Fear and Fellowship right off the bat. And that kept exploding every 12 or 13 months. And I realized that I had to, like, either get drunk every night or try something different. Because not drinking for me was lethal. It was lethal. I mean, my Texas story, just to finish that, it was right before I stopped drinking, right before I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. But a year before that, the vice president, he spent almost 2 hours with me going over. He went over a coverage for detox coverage, supplementary health care.
Right.
You know, rather than picking the color of my new company car, he wanted me to select a supplementary health plan for detox coverage. I mean, you know, so I think they're flying me to Texas to, you know, give me all these financial inducements, you know, make me take over West Coast operations. They just want to talk about detox with me. So,
and that's the last thing you want to talk about.
Well, that's the last thing I wanted. I was insulted. But, you know, what happened was I stopped. And you know, that can be, you know, early success, as you know, can be a real hazard to
alcoholic.
To long-term growth. I mean, it's like I was always a pretty decent athlete, but my brother, for instance, was 6 foot tall in fifth grade, and I was I didn't get 6 foot tall until I was sophomore in high school. I grew a foot in high school, and
when did you finally get a sponsor?
My sponsor used to drink with me. He lived right across the street. He'd been in AA about 9 years when I started.
You know, I went to Post Oak over
right
here.
Right away. He's a good guy.
And this one guy, Gary, would always say he's a motivational speaker, wrote a book, millionaire, and stand-up comedian. So people listen to what he has to say, and he would say, my sponsor told me as long as I didn't drink with my sponsee, I was a good sponsor. And, of course, I would get irate when he would do that and say, Gary, have you ever sponsored anybody that stayed sober? Well, no. I said, well, doesn't that tell you something? So it's funny to hear that you would go drinking with your sponsor.
Well,
so I take it that didn't work.
Before I came to AA, I knew him from up the street. I was in the nightclub area of Pittsburgh. I knew him from 10 years before. And he lived virtually across the street from me.
You didn't take the sponsor.
Yeah.
The steps with it. You did?
Yes. Yeah, he was a good sponsor. But let me tell you what happened. I'll tell you, I'm a go-getter. I like to identify problems and jump right on them.
Sure.
And, I get things done. And so I had him and his sponsor was almost like a backup sponsor. So I basically had two sponsors because I was special. I needed two sponsors. And I used to I was only 7 months in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I went up to the monastery, which is most people in Pittsburgh run up for their fifth step to the monastery. It's a one-shot deal. So
there
in order
go.
To get them off my back, I'm a writer, so I put together this. I thought it was a very compelling fourth step, very great story, and I put it together and ran up to the monastery for an hour and a half and read it to the monk, and I immediately jumped into the further step. I made amends to three women I wanted to see again and six clients that I wanted to keep. You know, and I don't
no
have to tell anybody in the audience.
No ulterior motive on that puppy, huh?
Yeah, I don't have to tell anybody in the audience how that program turned out. I mean, I went into the worst drinking of my entire life in the next 3 years.
Yeah.
You know, I was like the detox drunk of the year for the next 3 years. And I basically, there's a great line that we don't pay much attention to in the big book. It says, we have been defeated by self. You know, and I didn't realize that until my fourth detox. I had not been defeated by vodka. I had been defeated by self. You know, I was using the steps in the worst possible sense. I was using them for self-advancement. You know, like it was like
Poco,
a personal.
Yeah, Poco the alligator. We have met the enemy, and he is us.
Right.
So let me take just a moment and interject a couple of quick things for our listeners.
Oh, go ahead.
What I wanted to mention is that alcohol is a very dangerous drug. There are more overdose deaths from alcohol than all the other drug overdoses combined. So it is very dangerous to drink, and it's dangerous to quit. Last 2 years ago, I lost a man in one of my groups because he was secretly drinking heavily. He quit all of a sudden and had a seizure and died. So keep that in mind, folks. If you know someone that's drinking heavily, do not encourage them to quit all at once. No cold turkey advised.
You know, back in
the
day,
back
in the day in early AA, before there was the detox and all that, and a lot of the meetings, a lot of the clubs or the groups would have bottles of alcohol there for detox. They'd call it bug juice. And somebody would sit
right
up with you. There would be a couch there. They'd give you an ounce an hour or an ounce every 2 hours to titrate you down from the alcohol. And that seemed to work most of the time. Today it's a little bit more fancy. I usually tell my sponsees if they, you know, they might consider detox if they were a heavy drinker. But if they hadn't had a drink in 3 or 4 days, I don't believe that a detox is necessary at that point. What they need to do is start working the steps. Some people disagree with that is because, well, their mind is cloudy and they really can't read and all that. And I go, that's baloney. That's people put that in their mind. They're making an excuse why they can't get started. Dr. Bob was 3 days sober when him and Bill W. went to Towns Hospital and met Bill D. So, it can be done.
I did the first 8 steps in my last detox, you know, like 23 years ago. I mean, I did them. I mean, I was sick. I was the sickest I was in my entire life. I was not at the top of my game. And my original sponsor came into the detox and heard my new 5th step. And I was out hand delivering checks to people, good checks to people I'd harmed the day out of detox. I went to my home group and I couldn't even drive an automobile for about 6 weeks. I was so sick. So you can do, I mean, I don't recommend that way. I don't recommend going to detox and doing the steps, but that's what happened.
So it takes what it is. But you're serious now. So finally you got serious. So you're going to work the steps, you're going to work it with a sponsor, and you're going to work them sincerely.
Well, this is basically the method. I mean, I was sponsoring 6 people within 6 months. You know, after that misunderstanding at Chief's Cafe, and I still sponsor these people. We've all been sober over 20 years. I boot people through fairly quickly.
How long?
You know, I basically anywhere from about 3 to 8 weeks. I did them in 9 weeks, so anywhere from, depending on their previous exposure day, anywhere from 3 weeks to, I'd say, to 3 months. They basically substantially completed their amends. They've at least contacted everybody on their list.
Oh, good. Yeah, well, we're right on the same page with that. I usually tell them Joe McHugh from Joe and Charlie Tapes suggested 30 days. I usually suggest to my sponsees 30 to 45 days through the steps. Very rare it's going to be that fast, because usually once you stop drinking, you start getting a life back. And so the pressure is off, but I don't have them talking
meeting. I look at that as bad. You know, the good is the enemy of the best. Getting a little bit better was what happened to me every week when I was drinking. You know, I swore off vodka and tequila hundreds of times on Sunday morning and Monday morning, and you know, by Wednesday night I was ready to go out howling again. I got better in that 3 days.
That was Bill W. Sometimes the enemy.
Yeah, I got better in that 3 days. If I had stayed, you know, if we could stay drunk, nobody would ever come to meetings.
Really?
So, I mean, I basically realized that I've been defeated by self. And you hear that all the time. So, what did you do differently? And basically, what happened was I basically have like the academic background of a college professor or a financier, but I have the genes of an Irish longshoreman. You know, which is a bad combination. I mean, I drink like a longshoreman, you know, which makes me the most intelligent and patient in detox every time I end up there.
the smartest guy on the block. Right. You put that on YouTube.
I mean, right.
He was the smartest guy in detox.
Right. And so I basically realized that what I was doing for that first 4 years in the fellowship was lethal. I mean, it was just, you know, I could read. I basically have 2 degrees in statistics and econometrics, which is statistical economics. So, I mean, I know I can do forecasting very well that, you know, once you hit blood alcohols in the 40s, I mean, you're even if you're 300 pounds, you're going to die quickly. So
yeah, I had
basically realized
was 350 pounds and he died of anaphylactic shock. In a very short period of time, he drank about a liter rum.
Well, when I was relapsing, I was living with this woman who didn't like my drinking, and I was telling her I wasn't drinking. I was sneaking drinks 2 or 3 times a month, and so she like ground up. I tried the Anabuse experiment for a while. My psychiatrist said that would be a good thing to try. So she used to grind up my Anabuse and put it in my iced tea or lemonade. I used to run a lot, play racket sports. So it was like an assassination attempt. You don't hear about Anabuse. I mean, you want to die if you drink on it. But the whole point is, I know you're taking Anabuse. I didn't know I was taking Anabuse.
How about the spiritual aspect of the program? Had that grown? Was that a component in your finally realization?
I would say I basically got... I would have said I already was doing that quite a bit when I was relapsing, but I basically got much more disciplined on it. I would start the day first thing first, reading 3 or 4 meditation books, and have like this quiet period of meditation for, you know, up to an hour every morning. And I've basically continued that for over 20 years. I mean, I would have told, in fact, when I was talking to Joseph a couple of days ago, I told him I basically was in the Oxford group 2 years before AA. Some coworkers of mine from other companies that noticed that I looked terrible in the morning. And when Sam Shoemaker came to Pittsburgh in 1952, he started his version of the Oxford group called the Pittsburgh Experiment, and it's still around. And it basically is like the most traditional form. I think it's the best form of Oxford group. So basically it cut out most of my weekday drinking before I went to AA.
Do you have any tips for us when you take a sponsee through? Okay, how do you get them? Any particular steps that you use or any techniques or understandings tricks?
Well, Pittsburgh, most of the meetings in Pittsburgh, they used to be 9 o'clock at night big speaker meetings. Now in the last 20 years, they're almost all open discussion meetings and much earlier, 7 o'clock, 7:30. So by my home group is a big book study. But basically, most of the meetings I go to are open discussion meetings. So I basically will give a two and a half minute rundown of what I was like regarding the topic. Like if the topic is balance or something, I'll talk about being stopped by the Colorado State Police in 1983 in Aurora, Colorado, and asked to stand on one leg and count backwards. You know, that's what I know about balance. I'll give a little specific story that paints a general idea that my drinking was peculiar. And that's where I get mostly. I sponsor people. I mean, I people ask me to sponsor. I don't know, not virtually every week. Clearly every month, and I speak about twice a month. And basically, they're almost everybody I sponsor for more than a month has been in rehabs from 5 to 10 years. You know, they've been flailing. I mean, they're really bad drinkers.
Right.
And if you sit there and talk to them, I mean, they've been in rehabs from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters. You know, they know all about the disease. They know all about the disease. They can't stop drinking. And they aren't what you would call first-round draft picks. I mean, they're not promising.
Yeah, they know enough just to be dangerous.
Well, they. I mean, I was doing more steps than the average member, and I was still relapsing. I was a bad drunk. I was really bad. I had a good resume.
Some of us have a spiritual experience, and some it's given a spiritual awakening. Which one did you have?
I had a still small voice spiritual experience while I was in detox the last time. I knew it was over. It was like a poltergeist leaving.
No.
It's like, it was almost like an exorcist. Well, I would describe it not as a white light. It was like a still small voice. It was like a calmness that appeared out of nowhere. And I realized that I guess it was a voice saying, you know, it's over. I mean, you're not going to drink. And I haven't since that. Well, let me tell what might have precipitated, though. For 4 years, I had been asking God to keep me sober every morning.
Right.
And for the first time in my life, I asked what I could do for his other kids. I asked God what I could do to help his other kids. And I haven't thought about drinking. I haven't had the slightest urge to drink for over 20 years, like 23 years now. I haven't had the slightest urge to drink for, you know, I'm around alcohol all the time. And it's not, the problem has been removed. I mean, I was, we'll be relieved of alcoholism if we do these actions. I mean,
if you know this or not, it's in Job, the last chapter of Job, it says, Job was renewed when he prayed for his friends.
Mm-hmm.
That's what
right,
you would do.
The friends that were chastising him, actually.
Yeah, I know. What kind of friends? Yeah, they were telling him to eat shit and die. So,
yeah,
and
they were chastising that he probably heard that allegory about how, you know, the poor drunk falls in this deep hole and he's there wailing. He's trying to crawl out of it. He can. And the minister comes by and says, "You must have done something very sinful to get down in the hole." And then it's getting dark and all of a sudden above the hole there's this physician and throws him a prescription bottle down the hole and he says, "Here, take this and call me in a year." And then it's getting dark and he's really frightened. And this psychiatrist appears at the top of the hole and said, "Do you think your parents put you down in this hole?" So this guy is like crying and he's going to die in this dark hole and he's covered with mud. And all of a sudden he sees this bright light, or he sees two bright lights, you know, jumping into the hole. And it's two people that jump into the hole. He said, "Welcome. How can we help? We're members of Alcoholics Anonymous." And this poor guy in the hole looks at him. He said, "Well, now this is brilliant. All of us are trapped down in this hole." And the two members look at him and said, no, we used to be down here too, but we know the way out."
And oh, I like that.
I think there's a lot of accuracy to that story. You know, we don't tell drunks what to do because you can't.
Right.
You can't tell them what to do.
I put it to you this way. You could tell an alcoholic anything. You just can't tell them much.
Right. Yeah, I mean, we're going to do it our way, notwithstanding the evidence. So I basically start each day asking for to be divorced to self. I mean, I try to help somebody and not get caught, and then I thank the God of my understanding for giving me the power to row for another day. I mean, it's been doing that, and that's why. I mean, I don't think it's all that helpful even to talk about the peculiarities and particularities of my spiritual experience. I like to give evidence of it. And basically, I'm around alcohol constantly. I go out with people. I socialize with people who drink. And I don't even feel envious. I don't want to drink. I don't feel like drinking. I don't feel deprived. I don't feel like there's something missing. You know, the problem has been removed. And the book says that we'll be relieved of our alcoholism. Now, I was relieved of my wallet on back-to-back trips to New York City on Central Park West. You know, a month apart. That means it was taken away. I didn't have my wallet anymore. You know, so the book is saying that the alcoholism, the problem is removed. It's relieved. And that comports with my experience. I mean, it wasn't what I did. I mean, I tweaked it. I did some different things. Starting with my fourth detox. I started to stop praying for myself. I started to ask God what I could do to help his other children. And I basically tapped into the power every day before I needed it. You know, meeting tests was about the same. You know, economic conditions were about the same, social conditions. What changed was I started to tap the power, you know, before I got all jacked up during the day.
That's a great way to put it. Pray to be divorced.
I believe in taking people to the steps, thoroughly, honestly, and fairly quickly, so that they'll be able to take other people through the steps in a short time. I mean, I think that's their best protection.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Just helping
people. One immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This
right.
activity works when all other activities fail. I think we missed the boat. I usually get my sponsees after they've worked step five. Now they can talk in the meeting because I use that pain that they come in with as fuel to get them through. Step five is usually the answer. It's the beginning of a true kinship between God and man, and now they're available to be a temporary sponsor. The only requirement is they have to stay one step ahead of their sponsee. If they're willing to get passionate about working the program of Alcoholics Anonymous as outlined in the basic text, their best chance have a long-term and happy life free from alcohol. Is that your experience?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I a lot of times that's like my first assignment to sponsees is to tell them to look up that promise in chapter 7. I consider it almost the biggest promise in the whole book, immunity from drinking.
Yes.
And and we're not swearing off. We're not trying not to drink. We're not avoiding temptation. The problem is removed.
Basically,
just a 10-second summary is I took a series of actions, of 12 actions that I didn't think would work and didn't believe in. I'm pleased to report that, 23 years later.
Now you believe they did work.
Well, I believe now that they work. But I took 12 steps that I didn't think would work, that I thought I'd already kind of done, And I didn't believe in them, but I did them anyway. Yeah, I made
that
leap.
Right. I'm glad
to
see that.
I think
sponsorship is the key to long-term sobriety and working the steps on a regular basis. I tell my sponsees, too, step one is the problem. We can't drink. It has to be done perfectly. All the other steps are ideals. We do the best we can, and we're going to grow spiritually. And the way you know you're growing spiritually is that you become more effective in helping the next sufferer. That's how you know you're growing spiritually. You're always doing step three, right? You give it up to God. You take
it back. My third step's been about as perfect as my first. I mean, I start every day, in the steps. I never come out of the steps.
Yeah, you're always doing six. Who's entirely ready? In essence, nobody's ever entirely ready. You can only be as ready as you can be spiritually at that particular moment in time. Seven is that we're letting go of ego and we're letting God take care of the remaining character defects as they come up. And 10, 11, and 12, I believe, are the spirit, the growth steps. People say maintenance. I don't believe we maintain. The big book says, our sobriety is contingent upon the maintenance of a daily spiritual condition. My question is, what maintains itself of itself? Nothing, in essence, maintains itself. We're either growing spiritually or we're declining spiritually. And if you're declining spiritually, your sobriety and your recovery becomes tentative.
Well, I think that's the central theme of the book, is that self cannot defeat self. I can't fix the problem
with the same mind that created it.
Self put me into it, so it's not going to extricate me.
Right.
I relapsed four times in the 80s, explosively, and this is after lots of AA. And twice I was walking out of a meeting that I had enjoyed. I had this overwhelming compulsion to drink. My third relapse, I was at Easter Sunday church enjoying the music, and my brain said the bar's open at 11, so I turned to my date and say I had to go, and I got thrown out of a bar at midnight.
Yeah,
and
that much thinking relapse, was there, that much thinking.
Yeah, my fourth relapse occurs now, 13 months of not drinking and about 700 meetings in a row. My fourth relapse occurs, triggered by Sunday morning, 7 a.m., I'm in my house. I get this overwhelming compulsion to drink. So I have three triggers. It's my house, church, and meetings.
Yeah.
You know, which takes me to the first step, that I am screwed. I'm screwed. I'm
right.
Going to
drink. You're powerless. I tell my sponsor.
I cannot stay sober on my own power. And so my two original sponsors used to tell me, you know, you hear people say, oh, take your problems to your sponsor. Well, I used to try to do that. I'd call up Bruce and at 6:30 in the morning, he would open up the Episcopal chapel near us, and I see his house lights go on. I jump to the phone with my crises of the week. And I say, yeah, Bruce, this is John. You know, my wife wants to divorce me. My boss wants to fire me. Should I take this job in New York City? And
my
Bruce
dog
would say, yeah, my Bruce would say, you know, whatever, my dishwasher's broken or something. Yeah, it's whatever the crisis was. And Bruce would say, have you asked God for direction? And I said, Bruce, I said, I have real problems, and you have a master's degree. And he was a mining engineer. He had a master's degree in engineering. I said, give me some practical information. He said, ask God for direction. Call me at 10 o'clock tonight.
Perfect.
So I wasn't happy with his suggestion, so I appealed the decision to his sponsor at 8 o'clock in the morning. And I would call John McDee at 8 in the morning when he's having coffee, and I'd say, McDee,
your brand
John.
Sponsor.
Yeah, I would call the
grand
sponsor, and I said,
right?
I'm going to appeal to Caesar. So I call up John McDee, and I said, McDee, my wife hates me. She's trying to get out of the marriage and grab my assets, and my boss is squeezing me out, and this guy gave me a bad $1,000 check. Should I sue him? And McDee would say, have you talked to Bruce first? And I said, yes, sir. And he said, did he tell you to ask God for direction? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, do that. He hung up on me.
Yeah. I have that on the website because I won't give advice to sponsees. I try not to anyway. It's called Decision Making for Dummies.
Right.
And takes you through a sequence of the Benjamin Franklin laundry list, the pros, the cons, make a decision. And then ask God if it's the right decision. And if it's the right decision, you'll have clarity of thought and a calm feeling. If it's the wrong decision, you'll have stupor of thought and a negative feeling. Don't look back and go forward from there. If my sponsor goes, well, what would you do if you were me? I says, I'm not you, so I haven't got a clue.
Well, you know, 10 years later, I'm telling the same sad story to two guys. We had just done the third step prayer together, and I gave them big hunks of cardboard to write down the names of, you know, five people they wouldn't want to get on an elevator with. You know, we're going to start the first column of the fourth step. And I was telling these guys how lucky they were to have me guiding them through the steps, as opposed to those two meanies back in the 80s that almost killed me, those two mean sponsors that used to hang up on me. And these guys are 3-4 months sober. And the guy 3 months sober looks up from his cardboard list. He said, that's not why they hung up on you. I said, what do you mean? He said, they knew how explosive your drinking was.
Yeah.
If you relied on them, he said they knew that it was a death warrant if you relied on their human power.
Right.
That's why they hung up on you.
A sponsor's only job really is to get you into a personal relationship with your creator.
Yeah.
That's what the sponsor. So the one that was step 12, the one aspect of doing all the steps was a spiritual experience. That's the one reason we do all the steps, is to get a relationship
with our
creator.
Yeah, it's the result of the creator. Steps. Right, that's the result of the steps. I mean, that's the message in step 12. I mean, it's unavoidable. It's the unavoidable, inexorable view.
Right.
I think Bill Wilson, it's in As Bill Sees It, it's not in the book, but he talks about the essence of the spiritual experience is it gives you a whole new motivation to the recipient. You know, totally out of proportion to what you get through discipline or other types. It creates a whole new propulsion, as the book talks about.
Right.
So basically, the self-propulsion is removed, and you obtain a different type of propulsion. That's why, I mean, if you ask a lot of people, you sit in a parking lot and you ask people, what describe AA, what's it about? I think most people would say it's some kind of self-help program. It's pretty well known. They'd call it a self-help program, and I think that's a terrible description of AA.
Yeah, because that means we're still walking in the sparks of our own fire, and that's not what it's about.
Right. I mean, self-help didn't work for me. In fact, I used to, back in 1982, 83, I joined the Self-Help Book of the Month Club.
And yeah, I know.
I used to get adult. Well, I must have bought 200 self-help books in 1982, 83. I had boxes of them. And I used to get self-help books from women on our last date. I mean,
oh, because you knew you were not going to see her again and you wouldn't have to give back the book.
I get a book like, you know, like the Peter Pan Principle, you know, Little Boys Who Have Never Grown Up. And I used to get self-help books from my, you know, good bosses on the last day of work. You know, and I used to get self-help books. I used to buy it for myself.
Do you have any last words, though? We need to start winding it down. So do you have any advice, or do you have anything for the listeners?
My original slogan, there's a lot of cliches and slogans in AA, and unfortunately a lot of them take out the steps and a higher power. I developed a personal one some years back, and it's just take the steps and you'll be contacted.
There you
go. Just wait for the message. Like, take the steps, and you'll be contacted. And I think that synchronizes with the book, and certainly with my story that I got no relief until I jumped into the steps. And as I said, I took 12 actions I didn't think would work and didn't believe in, but I did them anyway.
And they worked for you. Well, thank you so much, John, for your time, especially the Super Bowl Sunday. I'm sure that's why we didn't have any call-ins, because of the Super Bowl. But that's okay. I'm not really all that interested in Super Bowl. It's interesting, but I think this is more important in the scheme of things. There'll be another one next year. Harold, do you have any last words?
Well, I really appreciate the sharing and the focus. I agree totally that the self gets us into all the trouble, and abandoning self is really what Jesus came to talk about too. So we're on the right track, and it's helped me a lot, and I really appreciate John sharing how it helped him. Thanks, Joseph.
Well, many of us abandoned cars when we were drinking. You know, which means when you abandon something, you give up all future claim. I mean, I think it's a stronger word than surrender. When I abandon something, I don't go back and ask for it again.
Right.
I
know that
self.
Feeling.
I abandoned self. Why?
You.
Because it didn't work.
I know.
Yeah.
It didn't work.
Well, thank you for your time. I'll end with this. I believe when we're in the service of our fellow beings, and that's sponsorship and service, when the service of our fellow beings, are we not in the service of our God? And when we're in that service, and in that moment, are we not divorced from self-delusion, self-pity, and self-seeking? And in that service, and in that moment, is that not when we make our conscious contact with our Creator, who lives from moment to moment, eternity to eternity, life everlasting? The magic words in AA is action and more action, for faith without works is dead. From radios in 150 foreign countries, including Mississippi, 2,600 towns, cities, and villages, and we're approaching 240,000 hits to the website. No money is being made, and we're anonymous to the 11th tradition. Best we can do on Facebook didn't work out that well, but for the most part, we try to stay anonymous according to the 11th tradition. This is not AA, but we use the big book because the big book works. I use what works. So thank you again. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.